This Sunday, more than 30,000 runners will take to the streets in the London Marathon. And among the masses will be six Maasai warriors in red robes, bearing shields and sticks. They'll be away from their village in Tanzania for the first time in their entire lives. And they're there running to raise money for clean drinking water back home. Now, London, of course, is a very different place from their African homeland, and the culture shock threatened to be severe. The British conservation charity Greenforce stepped in. Greenforce works with the Maasai in Tanzania, and the organization is serving as the Maasai's escort to British culture. Greenforce Managing Director Marcus Watts is on the line with us now to tell us about the Maasai warriors' quest and how they are faring through what I'm sure is some pretty serious culture shock. Hi, Marcus.
Good day, Rachel.
Good day. Thanks for being with us. First, let's talk a little bit about what these runners are trying to do, their quest, their mission to raise awareness and, more importantly, raise money for their villages.
The Maasai come from a very remote village in Tanzania, and one of the key problems that the Maasai have before we can really start helping creating a sustainable future is the fact they don't have any water. They currently are taking water out of a small lake which relies on rain, and if it doesn't rain for 2 or 3 years, this water can virtually turn brown as the cattle stand in it. And unfortunately, at the moment, 3 out of every 5 children in their village die by the age of 5 years because of the water. So a more of a proactive view of Africa, rather than us running for them, they want to come over and run the London Marathon. People then sponsor them, and that way they can pay for a borehole to give them fresh water and therefore a future for their village.
So let's talk a little bit about what their impressions have been of London and England. We got clued into this story in large part because of the guide that your organization put out, a pamphlet for the Maasai to help guide them through this visit. It's called Visiting England, and it's sort of an anthropological study of the English in some ways. Here's a little example. Although English people share a lot, they do not do so to the same extent that the Maasai do. If you see something that someone else has, parentheses, like a bracelet, and you like it, then the person will find it very unusual if you were to take it and wear it, end quote. So talk a little bit about the Maasai culture and what is their relationship to possessions, as illustrated in this little bit, for example.
Yes, obviously there are differences. For example, the Maasai basically don't have much, so they're very willing to share within their village. One person will wear the other person's blanket or the other person's beads. Unfortunately, that probably wouldn't work so much in the UK as the same as the US. If you wanted to borrow someone's car, I can't see them passing you the keys with a smile. So we just had to make them aware of that, as well as various other points as well. The fact that the Maasai don't wear underwear wasn't probably something they could do, especially if it's a windy day on the marathon.
Some of the details really drive home the fact that life is so different there. I mean, some of what you explain in the pamphlet is what a house looks like, and this is the kitchen where the food's prepared, this is the living room. Where are they staying when they're staying in London?
Fortunately, one of our staff's parents own a kind of small hotel which is outside London in the fields. They very much like seeing wildlife. And also because of the attention they're getting, it was only fair to them we move them out of London. And they love seeing different animals that they don't have back home in Africa.
Like, what are some examples of animals that they've been
seeing? Sounds strange to you, doesn't sound probably too exotic, but horses. They'd never seen horses before. So they thought when we pointed these out, they thought they were cows with long hair. Huh. So we had to explain those. And also British cows, probably like US cows, are much larger than the African cow. And in Africa, they tend to just have 1 or 2 cows. Seeing a whole herd of cows in one field, they thought was quite strange, especially when the next field was totally empty. They couldn't understand why the cows just walk across to there. So things like horses, cows, and have been something new for them to experience, plus the snow as well. They're probably the first Maasai in hundreds of years to see snow.
Well, let's talk a little bit about their experiences. They've been there now for a few days. They arrived last Friday, I believe. Have there been any missteps?
No, there's no kind of missteps at the moment. The snow was the biggest one because it was we weren't expecting it, so there was no preparation for that. They woke up on Sunday morning and suddenly all the grass was white, a phenomenon that they've never already seen before. Most of the other things we've prepared them for, the clothing-wise, the fact that you don't need to stop and say hello to everyone you meet because, frankly, they'll probably still be on the start line of the marathon 3 hours later if they tried that. But there have been unusual things that we haven't really thought of that they probably wouldn't like. A kind of typical English breakfast hasn't particularly appealed, even though it's the same kind of meat that they would have back at home. But so far, they seem to be enjoying it. The only problem is they're not going to sleep. Every night, they all sit up, the six of them together, chatting to themselves about what they've seen during the day.
I just imagine they're full of stories for their family. Are they writing letters to family?
Unfortunately, they can't actually write. They don't have numbers where they live. We've been teaching them English for the last 3 or 4 years, but in the Maasai language, you can write words, but you wouldn't tend to write a long letter. At the moment, they are very talkative. Any of our volunteers who've been to Africa has sat very late in the evening around the campfire, sharing stories with them. And I just know these stories from their visit to London for 10 days. Will probably be being told for generation after generation as it goes forward. And I think there's going to be a lot of long nights in their village when they return.
I want to read another excerpt from the pamphlet. This is a quote instructing them about a facet of British culture, British people. Even though some may look like they have a frown on their face, they are very friendly people. Many of them just work in offices and jobs they don't enjoy, and so they do not smile as much as they should do. How has putting together this pamphlet made you reflect on your people?
To be honest, every time I return from Africa, I always reflect on the Western world. Yes, it might sound strange, but what we had to do here at Greenforce was sit down and think of all the things that are different to them. That's why it's important that we had people here who've been living out there with them and would know things that would stand out. So, yes, when people have got their head down, they're leaving the underground trains to get upstairs and get onto the ground level and then down the street to their office, head down, probably not the best time that they all smile. But so far, they've had an amazing welcome here. Every time people see them in the street, they're wearing their traditional robes, they've got their jewellery on, and they create quite a sight when they go through central London. So far, they're receiving a very positive feedback from all the British and all the tourists here in London.
Have they had any negative experiences or negative comments on their time in the UK? I mean, something you pointed out in the pamphlet is the fact that locals are going to be dressed differently and sometimes perhaps even scantily clad, perhaps not in the snow that you're experiencing now, but you prepared them for the fact that women in particular might be wearing outfits that they might consider to be inappropriate or too revealing. Have they made any of those kinds of negative judgments?
Yes. Not at the moment. Fortunately, as you rightly say, the weather's precluding that. And also in the evenings, they're back in the countryside. So
so they haven't been out at the pubs
experiencing
that.
Well, the Maasai don't drink alcohol. So that was one of the points we had to list in our guide, was the fact that British people, like anyone around the world, that if they do drink, they can appear a little bit silly once they've had too much to drink. So it's just making the Maasai aware that this kind of brown liquid in a pint glass can affect people's judgment sometime. But clothing-wise, they are very traditional, the Maasai. They wear certain clothes. The Maasai men typically won't sit down for a meal if there's a woman present. The men have to eat separately from a woman. And so we're making sure that we kind of maintain this cultural identity. We don't want to change them into a Western way. We want to be able to them to eat the same food as they would eat back home and to be hopefully act as much as possible as they would back home, hence keeping them in the countryside overnight and just coming up to town whenever's needed.
They are such a distinct group of people who lead such completely different lives than we're used to. How have you kept the tendency to exoticize the Maasai at bay? I mean, it's so easy. Everyone wants to take their picture and be posing with them. And there is a risk of objectifying them a lot.
Exactly. One thing you will find, though, with a lot of the Maasai, especially the single male warriors who are at their prime, they are quite, and they don't mind me saying this, they can be quite vain. They've all had their hair braided specially to come over. And I'll be honest with you, having people surround them taking photographs, they seem to, some of them look like they've been doing it for all their life. They obviously haven't, but they're pretty relaxed about it at the moment. They know that when they return to their village with these stories, they will be raised at a level. And so far, they seem to be enjoying it a lot. There's lots of different things they point out. When they saw a policeman on a horse, it didn't really matter who was taking photographs. They just wanted to see this unusual animal with a man on its back. So they will look at what they want to look at, and they won't really be distracted. I think it also helps that there are six of them. They are warriors. They're all in their late teens, early 20s, and so there is that peer pressure.
I want to ask about the race itself. These young men are clearly good runners?
I'll be honest with you, the Flora London Marathon attracts some of the best runners in the world, and there will be runners out there to get times. Our runners are going to be running in a block of six. They'll be running with swords and shields, and they're much more into stamina. They will typically run 12, 14, 15 hours day after day.
You say they run 14 to 15 hours a day. Why?
If they need to, yes. The Maasai basically feel all cattle in the world is theirs, which is a bit unfortunate if they come across someone else's cattle. They'll then take those cattle and then run back to their village with them. So if those cattle are maybe a couple of days away, they'll literally keep on running because they've probably been chased by another tribe.
How has this been for you, Marcus?
It's been interesting. As you can probably imagine, it's been
challenging, that answer.
Challenging. To be honest, it's a culmination of a lot of the past. It seems, to be honest, a long time ago that I sat down under a tree in the Maasai lands with the elders and discussed for about 4 or 5 hours in the blazing sunshine about this idea of coming over to my village, i.e. London, and doing a run in London and getting the blessing from the elders and making them aware that this was not just for the Moran, the warriors who came over, but it was for the village as a whole.
Was it hard to convince them, Marcus, that this was a good idea?
They want to know the details. They want to know their warriors are safe. Those warriors protect them. They protect them against lion. They protect them against other tribes. You can't take those warriors away and not return them. And they want to know they'll be safe in our hands.
Mm-hmm. Marcus Watts, thank you so much. Marcus is the managing director of Green Force, the organization that has helped bring six Maasai warriors to participate in the London Marathon this Sunday. Thanks very much, Marcus.
Thank you very much, Rachel.
So that was an example of a kind of extreme culture shock.
Amazing.
But, you know, this is something, if you've traveled abroad at all, everybody goes through this.
Yeah, it's funny. I was telling you that I was in Nanyuki in Kenya, out in the bush country with Work Miss Maasai for a story, and the women shave their hair, and anybody who's seen me knows I have gigantic curly hair, and they couldn't believe my hair. The women just kept coming up and touching my hair like, what is it?
Because as he mentioned in the interview, men get to grow their hair out, but apparently women shave their heads. And I had so many stories about when I went to India about 10 years ago. I had no clue what I was doing. And I landed, I was visiting a friend, and she pretty much knew that I was going to be out of my mind because India is so overpowering,
oh my
senses
gosh, I can't
and
imagine.
Sights. And so she basically paid for a car, and she just put me in the car, and she's like, go for a day and go deal with your culture shock, which was actually a really brilliant idea. Now, that whole thing was exacerbated by the fact that I had been taking my anti-malarial medication. You're supposed to take it once a week. I was taking it every day for a month. Now, for those of you who've ever been on anti-malarial medication, it makes you a little bit crazy in the head. So my culture shock was really intense. Yeah.
I think we should put up a post in the blog about culture shock.
I think we should,
when people
too.
Have experienced it.
Lots of stories.
Oh, do check back with our blog, npr.org/Bryant Park. Hey, that's it for the show. The BPP is directed by Jacob Gans, edited by Trish McKinney, and produced by Dan Pashman.
Our technical director is Manoli Weatherall, assisted by Josh Rogerson. Our staff also includes Ian Chillog, Wynne Rosenfeld, Angela Ellis, Caitlin Kenny, Nathan Duell, and Mark Garrison.
And Zina Bearcat. Don't want to forget
Indeed.
Zina. Laura Conaway edits our website and blog.
Our senior producer is Matt Martinez. Sharon Hoffman is our executive producer.
I'm Allison Stewart.
And I'm Rachel Martin. We are online all the time at npr.org/Bryant Park. Come visit us there. Come back again. This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. Thank you.